order. Welcome, everyone. We have a full agenda today, and we will start out. We have a PowerPoint presentation on Senate Bill 493. Is that correct? Is that just 490? Is that the only one? Yeah, it's 493, and so we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 493. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 493 would allow a person who is lawfully using a bicycle, moped, or other motorized vehicle to proceed through a red light at a top of the T intersection after stopping at the light under specified circumstances.
Thank you. We have DJ Heffernan here to testify for this with a PowerPoint presentation. Just hand it to the committee staff and identify yourself for the record, and we'll get going here. Welcome to the committee. Are you ready?
I am, as soon as I can get this machine to run.
Are we getting a copy of this PowerPoint, Madam Chair? Because I can barely see it, and I know Senator Whitsitt can't see it at all.
They just told me to send it.
Members to migrate over to the other end of the podium.
Okay, that's a good option. We'll do that.
I brought along one set of slides that I can hand out.
Okay, we could have those copies for committee members. Are you having trouble? Would you?
Yeah, this thing is jammed and doesn't seem to want to start. So.
Okay, well, we have two choices. We could put this off if this is solvable in a period of time, or we could just you could just do your best without the
agenda that you say you have. Let me see if I can get this to go. It doesn't want to start up. We can just dispense with this.
Okay, I appreciate that.
I don't know. Diagram.
Can you identify yourself for the record, please? Thank you.
My name is Daniel Heffernan. I live at 6016 Southwest Idaho in Portland, and I'm here concerning Senate Bill 493, testifying in support of the measure, which relates to the lawful use of bicycle lanes. I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 493. I'd first like to express my thanks to Senator Burdick, who took a personal interest in this matter on my behalf when I sent her an email about a year ago. And I'm especially grateful to the work of her staff in taking a sketch that I sent along with a description of a change in the law and presenting that to ODOT's Safety Division to come up with the measure that's before you. The idea for this proposed change to the Oregon Vehicle Code occurred to me while riding my bike. There are three or four rides I regularly take from home to commute to work or for pleasure that pass through T intersections. Imagine that you are riding on a bike in a bike lane on a busy street and you approach a stoplight. At that light, there is no street or driveway access of any kind to your right. Traffic is stopped to let vehicles approaching from the left turn onto the road that you are traveling. It occurred to me while sitting at such an intersection that there's nothing in front of me except my bike lane, there's no traffic to my right, and the cars are turning into their own travel lane, so why am I standing here? If I go through the light, is it against the law? The situation I've described feels to a cyclist like drivers my age used to feel back in the 50s and 60s when we could not make a right turn on a red light after stopping. Back then, that was considered running the light until someone came up with the bright idea that if there are no cars coming, why not allow the driver to make the right turn, even though technically that maneuver is against the red. The change proposed in Senate Bill 493 is in essence the same concept as the free right turn on red for cars. The law would apply only in circumstances where the cyclist is traveling in a continuous bike lane, is stopped by a red light, encounters no vehicular access points to his right when moving through the intersection, and the privilege could only be exercised after coming to a foot down stop. Exhibit A illustrates the stop-and-go rule for cyclists. The diagram shows a typical T-intersection controlled by a traffic signal. The arrows in the bike lane show the direction of bike traffic, obviously with traffic. And under the proposed change, the cyclist traveling north along the top of the T would be allowed to proceed through the intersection after stopping. Note that the bike lane for the northbound cyclist continues through the intersection, and also note that there are no access points, public or private, to the northbound cyclist's right. If there were, the rule would not apply, nor would the rule apply if the cyclist is sharing a travel lane with cars. The cyclist traveling south through the T-intersection would not be permitted through the intersection on a red light at any time for obvious safety reasons. Why make this change? Well, maybe the most obvious reason is because it's common sense. In the same way that drivers in the 50s and 60s who used to stop at a right at red lights and say to themselves, I know this is against the law, but stopping here is so dumb. Many cyclists go through the same mental calculus when they encounter the situation shown in Exhibit A. I've brought some slides that maybe I'll show you. Many cyclists go through, but before showing the slides, there's one other brief comment I want to make about extending the privilege that I've just described to mopeds and scooters. I oppose that. This provision would essentially let moped riders move into the bike lane and proceed through the red light with the bikes. I'm opposed to this and was glad to learn that the original language in the bill has been modified. Perhaps that hasn't, but if it has not, I prefer to stay with the existing restrictions that are in the Motor Vehicle Code in ORS 811.2605 that defines which types of vehicles may use the bike lane, and I favor leaving that section unchanged and not modifying that section by any proposed language in this measure. So if I can go through this the slide presentation very quickly here. I'm going to skip some of these images, but they're all in about a 2 or 3 mile radius of my home. There's a bunch of intersections that I encounter that have T intersections like I've described. And I've got examples that show not only where the law would apply, but also some that show where it would not. The intersections are Shoals Ferry Road at the exit from Oregon 217, exit 4B, Beaverton Hillsdale Highway OR 10 at Southwest 39th, Southwest Barber Boulevard at Hamilton, Shoals Ferry at Marjorie Lane in Beaverton, which is the controlled access for McKay School, Southwest Highway Capital at Sunset Boulevard, which is also a controlled access for Wilson High School, and one other intersection. I may not show all of those to you, but I'll leave the slides that do show pictures of those so you can get a sense for it. I think what I'll do is just show one example where it's pretty obvious where where this rule would apply, and then maybe one example where it's pretty obvious why it would not.
Okay, I think we're having technical problems. I think your diagram is actually quite clear.
Okay.
And I think that will probably be sufficient. I wanted to ask you on the moped, and maybe I should wait for the Department of Transportation witness, but on the moped and motorized wheelchairs, that type of thing, if someone is disabled and using a motorized wheelchair, I mean, do they normally use bike lanes anyway?
They're allowed to under 811, whatever the reference was to that statute. Yes, they're allowed to. But a moped or a scooter is not.
They're supposed to stay out of the bike lane.
Right.
So
right.
I think I hear your point. I think the bill, and I agree with you, it's broadly written. It should be changed to allow only those types of vehicles that are legally allowed to use a bike lane to take advantage of this. I'm seeing not even.
Correct, and that would be my suggestion, is just make a reference to 811-265, which defines who can use a bike lane.
Okay, and you got that, Council?
Yes.
Okay, we will get an amendment drafted up.
Well, we need to know
that. Do that. Okay.
This is, real quickly, what this is at, if you come off of Highway 217 at Shoals Ferry, this is the intersection that you come up to, and that's with the cars that are coming off of that that exit from Highway 217. That's the maneuver that they're making. If you're sitting in the bike lane, this is what you see. There's a guardrail to your right all the way through the intersection. You've got that bike lane that's in front of you. There's no traffic from your right. And so no point really to just sit through the light. And there are several examples like this. This is on Beaverton Hillsdale Highway. Another example on Barber. I want to show this is on Sunset on Capitol Highway coming up to Sunset. And this is a situation where this would not apply. The rule would not apply. Technically, the driveway to the right is a private access driveway for Wilson High School. It's not a public road. But because there is access to the right, even though it's private access, the provision would not be extended to cyclists to go through the red light here. And this is another example of that same situation where it's a no-go situation. The driveway that you see to the right is the driveway coming out of Harmon Swim Center, and because that access point is to the right, the cyclist would have to wait for the light to change. So
okay.
That's the summary of my
thank you
testimony.
Very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. What happens if there's a bicyclist or a whatever else is can legally use the bicycle lane coming in from the other end of that key intersection, and that person is turning into the bike lane?
The yield is to the cyclist going north, so they're merging into that bike lane. So you would have to wait for them.
So in other words, the person who has the green light would have to yield to the person who has the red light.
No, the person who has the red light would have to yield to the person who has the green light. In other words, it would be the same situation as if you're stopped at a red light and you want to make a right turn in your car. You have to wait for that lane to clear before you make the turn, and the same situation would apply to a cyclist yielding to another cyclist.
But they don't
and yielding for pedestrians that are crossing as well.
The wonders of traffic law. We don't get much traffic law in this committee, but we get some. Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there other questions in the committee? Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Mr. Heffernan is my neighbor, and I have actually biked by several of those examples myself. Okay, now we have Scott Bricker signed up.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the policy director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And I just wanted to have a short testimony here just to bring up a couple issues and things that we think are good about this bill. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance is an organization, a statewide organization with 4,000 members, and we represent bicycling and the bicycle industry. Generally, we're neutral to concept of this bill. We think it has some really good points to it, and some things we want clarifying as well. Generally, we feel that cycling through the T intersection, as described by this bill, would be safe. Something that I also confront in my daily bicycle ride to work, and I think generally would be a safe behavior. There also within the traffic code, and there are many examples of exceptions, sort of like the right turn on red, or there are other times where there's a stop sign where a vehicle can take a right without stopping but has to stop if it goes straight or left. So I feel like this is a reasonable exception here. And it also would just be one of those additional convenience for cyclists, making cycling more attractive. I think if we had any concerns about this, they're just potentially public perception concern, and so we'd hope that there would be some public education that would go along with this, either through the DOT and through cities as well. But mostly I wanted to also second the proposed amendments, and that's the bottom of my testimony, there's what I chalked up what might be the proposed amendments based on what Daniel was talking about with motorized scooters. ORS 811-440 actually defines what motorized vehicles can use a bicycle lane and what can't. And it says, for example, mopeds, if they're not under motor, could use it. So if you're pedaling a moped like a bicycle or an electric-assisted bicycle as a bicycle, you can use it. It says in there that electric wheelchairs can use it. So it lists the things already. And so we would hope that this would just be changed to reference the existing ORS as opposed to add new vehicles to being added to the bike lane. And okay, that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have John Jackley from ODOT. The committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Jackley, the Executive Officer for the Highway Division at the Oregon Department of Transportation. We had a concern in the course of drafting the bill that because the bill as written allows the bike user to proceed through the red light after stopping if a street or private access does not intersect the bike lane. We looked at it from a traffic engineering standpoint and thought that it might be strengthened somewhat if you replaced street or private access with the phrase highway, private road, driveway, or alley. And that would take into account those instances where accesses other than a street or a private access would intersect the bike lane. We think that it would be safer for all involved and would recommend the adoption of that Dash 1 amendment. We did work with the chair in the preparation of it.
I appreciate that very much, and I think that was a very positive change and certainly within the intent of this bill. Are there questions of Mr. Jackley? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will work on the amendment to make sure that people who aren't normally authorized to use the bike lane are continued to not be authorized to use the bike lane in these circumstances. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 493. And we will open, I think right now we will... Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 229 and Senate Bill 234, and we are going to move Senate Bill 229 and Senate Bill 234 to tomorrow's agenda because we just now got the amendment that kind of consolidates these two bills. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 229 and 234. And now we will open up. Well, are we waiting on the scrivener?
I can find out from you. Yeah, just a minute, I'm sure.
We'll be in recess for just a moment here. We will return from recess, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2261. Council?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2261 is a Scrivener's bill that corrects grammar and punctuation errors throughout the Oregon Revised Statute and deletes several obsolete references.
You've read this. Yes. And we have been honored by the presence of Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council Office. Mr. Hendricks, welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Council's Office. I know during the session you frequently get bills before you that are advertised as being housekeeping. This one truly is housekeeping. It's generated by our office from our reading of the statutes, both in the course of preparing bills and also after session. When you complete your session here every year, you come out with 800 to 1,000 laws that you have passed. And in those laws, you amend sections, you create new sections, you repeal sections. We take those laws after session, our office does, and we compile them into the existing laws to generate what eventually becomes the old and revised statutes, the 19-volume set of statutes that reflects the laws that stands at the time that that publication is put out. While we're doing that, one of the things we do is actually read the statutes, and we read from cover to cover the entire thing, our attorneys do, and in the process they spot things that are problems. And most often than not, they are not problems that arose out of the previous session or even the previous several sessions. They are things that date from time immemorial, from back perhaps to the time when a statehood was created. And we make what's called special attention notes, which basically is a note indicating we've spotted a problem. And during the interim, we put together what we refer to as a revisor's bill, which is 2261 in front of you, which makes non-substantive changes, corrections to grammar, syntax, brings up these statutes to the current form and style as opposed to the older form and styles that may have been used at one time, or even in statutes that were adopted before there was a recognized form and style for statutes. So it's a big bill, but not a very exciting bill. You can see after each section there's a little notation indicating why the change is being made. You should have, on this particular bill, we have not had very many comments. Agencies tend to look at them carefully to make sure that we haven't done things inadvertently. You should have a set of -1 amendments to the bill, I hope, that respond to one issue that was raised on the House side, an interesting statute that had much language talking about doctors and then defined physicians, even though physician was not used in the statute. We changed physician to doctor, and the Oregon Medical Association indicated they preferred that be physician. So the statutes basically changed that statute to use the term physician. The other thing the amendments do are to incorporate certain changes that were necessary because of the rules that were promulgated by the Council on Court Procedures, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure changes that they submit every session. There were changes necessitated by that in the statutes, and we felt it would be appropriate to do those as an amendment to the revisor's bill. The only question I've received here today, in addition to that, is respect to a change made on page 231 of the bill. And on that page, we have amended some definitions that are used for the purposes of ORS chapters 441 and 442. And what we have done is eliminated the definition of medically indigent. That's on the middle of the page, line 19. The reason we have done that is because medically indigent not only is not used in 441 or 442, it's not used. That term isn't used anywhere in the ORS. So at this point, it is a definition that applies to nothing. And we, of course, try to avoid that. And so that's the reason why that change has been made on that page. And with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
We're still in search of the -1 amendments. I had this big, thick thing in my file, and I thought it was the -1 amendment, but in fact, it's part 2 of the bill. This is one big conquer of the bill.
It's a 2-volume bill.
Yes. The -1 amendment is actually quite short, and I had thought that it was going to be a longer piece. We're in the process of ordering, of getting that printed and presented. And I think you already described the the changes that would be made. The main change is to change the word doctor to the word physician to be consistent with what else is in the statute. Initially, I had wanted to hold on to the bill for a while just to see if anybody else had any changes, because we had an agreement with the House Judiciary Chair to only amend it once to avoid this huge printing process every time it's changed. But I think we'll, with your excellent explanation, I think we'll go ahead and go on the assumption that there is a place for trust in this process. Thank you.
Thank you,
is there any questions of Mr. Hendricks from the committee? Okay, Senator Starr, do you have an amendment? Oh, excuse me. We're still in public hearing. We have nobody else signed up. Would anybody else like to testify on this bill? We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2261, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2261.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2261.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2261. Are there any questions or comments, Senator Barr?
Okay, question, Madam Chair. Mr. Hendricks spoke of the physician and doctor, and that seems to be page 3 of the Dash 1 amendments. I'm wondering what sections 4A and 4B do with the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Hendricks, could you, he's talking about, you're talking about starting on page 1, line 4. You start page 1, line 4.
Yes, Madam Chair, we seem to be adding two new sections to the bill, and maybe that has to do with doctors to physicians also, but it isn't evident as looking at those two.
I think that has to do with what else he said it did, and I'll let him repeat that. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, Senator Byer, Dave Hendricks again. These were the changes that were needed because of the rules adopted by the Council on Court Procedures. They do the rules of civil procedure, and they submit them to the legislature every session. And when they do that, sometimes they're not quite as careful as we are about looking for other references. For instance, on page 1 of the Dash 1's amendments, they neglected to adjust some references in another rule when they made changes in Rules 83. And we could have left that until next session, but since we had the revisor's bill as an opportunity to correct that, we went ahead and put it in because it was an obvious change that non-substantive to adjust the statutes, actually in this case adjust the rule to make it consistent with what they had done. And that's the same on 4B as well.
Okay.
Thank you. Is that it? Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Walker, do
you
have
I had a couple of questions, actually, Mr. Hendricks.
Why don't you just stay there until this is done, Mr. Hendricks?
I love reading these bills. This is fascinating.
You're doomed to carry this, you know.
Well, the fun part is on page 197, they take out the word manpower and replace it with workforce, so I appreciate that as a woman. But, Mr. Hendricks, on page 153, we change, we have this term now called the Common Council. Is that, I'm taking from my reading of that that's a city council. And it's now being called a common council?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I won't pretend to tell you that I know the meaning behind every one of these changes
right.
that were done by the individual drafters, but I assure you that we would not have made up the term common council. That must be a term used in Chapter 221, which is the chapter on cities. So we're talking about municipal law,
mm-hmm.
and I presume that the common council, if we go and pull it out, would turn up in Chapter 221 as being a term that's used there.
Okay. I was noticing, Madam Chair and Mr. Hendricks, on page 154, line 11, they added the word lewd, but they just sort of changed its where it's located in the sentence. So common councils have the right to prevent and suppress bawdy houses, and that's bawdy, B-A-W-D-Y, lewd and lascivious cohabitation. I wonder what that means. Opium smoking houses and places occupied or kept therefor. I'm really...
Buck, you certainly have found the juicy section of this Senator's bill. I commend you.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, you know, this is one where we really are conservative about changes we make because we want to be able to present this and say this is totally non-substantive. But there certainly is a role for doing more comprehensive looks at these statutes. And it's a role that to some degree has been filled by the Law Commission in the past or before mm-hmm. that the Law Improvement Committee. It's something the legislature does need to think about from time to time because the statutes do get to have a lot of terminology, et cetera, that looks pretty obsolete, pretty antiquated, may not reflect realities, and hopefully in the future there will be opportunities to come into all of these chapters and look at them hard and make decisions about whether or not the terminology that's used in these things should be updated and, you know, if necessary, look through and see if it still makes sense. In some cases, we see statutes that don't make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But we're conservative in this bill. We do keep other set of special attention notes that are more substantive in nature, and those are the ones where we will frequently come back to the requester and say, by the way, while we're in amending the statute, would you like to address this problem that we spotted with obsolete or language that doesn't make sense? And some requesters are happy to do that. Others are unwilling to, are interested in making one change and do not want to do that sort of statutory cleanup sort of thing that would be helpful, but sometimes involves a policy choice. So
yeah, the policy choice is very clear to prevent and suppress body houses. That's spelled B-A-W-D-Y for those who are listening in the audience.
I wonder what, Madam Chair, what lewd and lascivious cohabitation.
I think we have the League of Oregon Cities here. So we might ask them if they'd like to go in and do something.
I would like to nominate Section 165 ORS 221.916. As a prime candidate for updating, given some of the things I've read in here. But I appreciate your commitment to make these non-substantive and non-controversial because of the purpose of this bill. So are there other questions? Thank you. Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes, I would move House Bill 2261.
No, you need the dash one amendment first.
I thought we did that already.
Oh, you did, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I'm just behind the top.
We haven't approved that, though.
I guess I just have to go. Oh, that's right.
We were in discussion.
Is there any objection to the dash one amendment?
We just got carried away.
Now, Senator Starr, I got carried away by the body houses here. So.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2261 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2261 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Walker, since you made that wonderful find, you get to carry the bill.
Oh, all right, Madam Chair. I will look for some more entertaining.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. I think it's safe to go now.
Oh.
Okay. Let's see. Order. I think we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 492, and I wonder if we should do both of these. Let's see. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 492. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 492, it would create a new provision to the vehicle code for failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian. It repeals the current statute concerning such conduct.
Thank you. And we have signed up on this. Troy Costales is here.
Okay.
closing rules.
Oh, yeah. You go ahead. We're going to wait till 2:30 and try to work a bunch at once. Thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 492 is modifying motor vehicle code in relationship to car drivers and pedestrians in relationship to last session's Senate Bill 315, where there was a difference between when a motorist encounters a pedestrian at a signalized or controlled intersection versus an unsignalized intersection, which is just like out in front of the Capitol here towards the fountain where there's no signs or signals. In a signed and signaled area, a motor vehicle driver must wait for the pedestrian to cross all lanes of traffic unless there's a pedestrian island partway through on the road before they are allowed to proceed straight or to make a turn. Senate Bill 492 changes that to be the lane that the driver is in plus one lane before they are able to move forward or to make their turn. It makes it equivalent to what is there now in relationship to the unsignalized intersections in the state. And my understanding is there are some questions in relationship to some of the downtown settings and mass transit vehicles moving. And at this point in time, Madam Chair, I can't address those. There are others that have that to present to you as a question for you on this particular bill.
Okay, appreciate that. I'm aware of some of the concerns, and we'll look forward to hearing those. Are there questions, of Mr. Costales? This bill also is, and I'm trying to look for my bill folder here. I'm having trouble finding it. This one combines the two provisions into the same provision of the vehicle code. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. In current statute, you have the signalized intersection in motor vehicle code in one area and unsignalized in another, and this bill would bring them all together so they're consistent.
Okay, so regardless of, there are other bills around the building, and as I understand it, they maintain the separate provisions for signalized and non-signalized, but this is the only one that keeps them together. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, you are correct. House Bill 2109 has been heard in House Transportation, and it addresses the issue of the lane plus one, but does keep things, the two areas separate, as Bill Senate Bill 492 brings them together.
Okay, thank you. Okay, are there questions of Mr. Costales? Senator Starr?
Yes. This is repealing a law that we passed just last session that required drivers to stop until they've got all the way across the four-lane road.
And Senator Starr, it repeals one portion from Senate Bill 315 from last session, just dealing with the signalized intersections to make it lane plus one instead of all lanes.
Thank you.
Okay, so the way it passed last session, because I was actually the sponsor of Senate Bill 315, and the intent was to deal with the non-signalized crosswalks, and the signalized ones were put in there just to be consistent. So what you're saying is that we didn't put lane plus one for signalized ones.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And so you can understand how that might have caused some distress in some of our urban areas, Senator Starr. Okay, are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Okay.
I hope you'll stick around in case there are other questions.
I will.
Next we have Scott Bricker. Actually, let's take Mark Landauer and Mark Lear from the City of Portland. You know, I see that your comments are related to this Senate Bill 591, too, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 591 as well and add it to this agenda here. So welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I've asked Mark Lear, who is the city's traffic investigation manager for the city, who has considerable experience in these matters, to appear before you today to talk about Senate Bill 492. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Lear. I'm the manager of the Traffic Investigations Group for the City of Portland's Office of Transportation. I also manage our community and school traffic safety program, which includes our Safe Route to School effort and specific efforts to improve pedestrian and bicycle safety for the city. I'm real pleased to be here today. From my perspective, the passage of Senate Bill 315 last session was one of the best things that the legislature did to improve safety for pedestrians. And I want to thank the committee and obviously Senator Burdick for your leadership on that last session. Just a little bit of background before I talk about what we think about the current legislation. Pedestrian crashes in the city of Portland and throughout the state are a very significant issue. Between 1985 and 2002, there were over 4,000 pedestrians hit in the city of Portland. That's equivalent to a pedestrian being struck every 1.5 days. And unfortunately, two-thirds of these collisions result in some kind of the requirement for some kind of medical treatment. We also had 217 fatalities between 85 and 2002, or more than one fatality per month of pedestrian being struck. Part of why this bill has been so valuable to us, or Senate Bill 315 was, or is that prior to that change in law, there was tons of confusion about what a driver responsibility was for a pedestrian in a crosswalk. It wasn't just that the general public was confused about it. There was lots of times I'd sit in a meeting with traffic engineers where we'd sort of debate about, well, does the car really have to stop, or does it just have to yield, and how does that work? And so from my perspective, the lane plus one language that a number of states have, including the state of Washington, is a really strong position, especially at the uncontrolled intersections. The problem with this bill, or with the implementation of Senate Bill 315 to include signalized intersection, wasn't just that currently it means you have to wait until the pedestrian's all the way out of the crosswalk. It's also that in some environments that requiring a lane plus one, it leads to some congestion problems where cars, if they want to obey the law, especially at signalized locations, would lead to some gridlock and would be a major issue for transit agencies and that sort of thing. The good news is that there's a group of legislators and advocates that I know Senator Burdick's office has been involved in, and Representative Burley as well, it's been meeting to look at, is there something where we could still add the protection at signalized intersections but not have that operational problem? And my sense is with something like a lane plus half a lane or something like that for signalized intersection, there's a way we can get there. I would like to really stress, and that's part of why I brought this visual here, that I do think it's really important that we provide some level of protection at signalized intersections. The reality is that in Portland between 85 and 2002, 39% of pedestrian injuries occurred where the pedestrian had right of way in a crosswalk and was struck by a vehicle. About two-thirds of those accidents, though, occur at signalized intersections. So it is really important, I think, that we have a clear message that we can provide to drivers at signalized intersection. That said, we don't want to put drivers in a situation where they can't meet the law certain times of the day, and so we're looking for a compromise. I did bring this graphic that's just in front of you, which shows crashes that occurred, pedestrian injuries that occurred in the city of Portland in the downtown business district between 1990 and 2000. And part of what it would highlight there is that over 70% of those collisions occurred as a fault of the driver hitting a pedestrian when the pedestrian had right of way in a crosswalk. And most of those occur at signalized intersections. So when we're in the process right now of, with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition and other groups, of going out and doing a speakers bureau around this new law to explain to people what the law means and why they should pay attention. And from my perspective, clearing up the language at signalized intersection with a lane plus a half or something like that will put us in a really strong position to go out and do that education. Thank you.
Thank you. And do you think that there's value in this approach of putting both the signalized and the non-signalized in the same section so that traffic enforcement officers can have them together?
I do think that probably makes sense. I think one of the recommendations coming out of the work group, too, is to talk about marked and unmarked crosswalks, have that language in the law, even though technically you know, a marked and unmarked crosswalk have the same protections. I think that's one of the big communication things that we struggle with. Another piece I guess I would just throw on the table is I think long-term, a really good direction for the state to go would actually be consolidating a lot of the pedestrian language in the vehicle code. I think that's part of what led to somewhat of an unintended consequence last session in how the fix at unsignalized intersections got applied more broadly. I think that the direction of simplifying that and making it clear could really help us out in communicating to the public the requirements and just implementing the law.
Thank you. And from my standpoint as someone with a particular interest in how this is being implemented, it is really, really helpful to have the crosswalks painted on the street. It makes it so much more clear. I know that that's not the definition of a legal crosswalk, that a legal crosswalk is any place between intersections, but it's so much more helpful to drivers to see that white crosswalk. And I wouldn't think that would be a very high-cost tool to use. So, are there questions? Thank you very much. Okay, now we have Scott Bricker, Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is still Scott Bricker, but I also do lobbying services for the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition as well as the Bicycle Transportation Alliance for walking and bicycling issues. Thank you for hearing me. I appreciate actually testifying after the City of Portland because we've been working with the City of Portland, some other stakeholders, clearly, and appreciate Senator Burdick and members of the committee's work on this last session and the work on it this session as well. In general, the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition advocates for pedestrian rights for people crossing the street, and in general, we are trying to craft a bill that is as safe as that creates a situation that's as safe as possible for walkers. We prefer and believe that the lane plus one lane, as defined in the Stop and Stay Stop bill, provides a maximum level of protection for walkers, but have had an opportunity to spend some time with the City of Portland, the chair of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition Board, and understand some of the issues that are brought up in downtown environments, and also are okay with and can support some type of change to that, whether it's 6 feet or half a lane, and would like to talk further about that kind of change in a work group environment. Under those circumstances, the City of Portland has assured us, and we'd just like to publicly testify that we'd like to see additional education and enforcement around pedestrian issues in downtown and signalized intersection areas. So we support this bill and appreciate your work, and I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? I want to say how much I appreciate the work that the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition has done on this. It's the coalition is very broad-based. It includes traffic enforcement officers. Is Lieutenant Hess still coming to coalition meetings from Hillsborough?
Yeah, we have a variety of people coming kind of in and out. He hasn't been the last couple of meetings, but he's still involved with the organization.
Yeah, he's been a particularly strong proponent. So thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
I think we will continue to hold this bill and work with our counterparts on the House side and hopefully be able to get a bill that will combine the two, the signalized and the non-signalized, in the same section. And we will just appreciate the efforts of the City of Portland and the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition to continue working with that process. Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 492 unless there's somebody who wants to jump up and testify. Thank you. Okay, now we have a public hearing on Senate Bill 591, which is a related bill, and there's no one signed up, Senator Pruszynski, so we're going to be counting on you. And we'll wait till council summarizes here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 591 would clarify that a driver is not liable for a traffic violation of failing to stop for a pedestrian where that pedestrian is in a bicycle lane or part of the roadway where the vehicle normally stops, stands, or parks.
Senator Pisanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did expect someone from the city of Florence from the police department to be here based on notes that went back and forth. I'm not sure why they aren't here. What I can tell you is that they have ran one or two sting operations after the bill passed in 2003 in an attempt to for driver education and for compliance. It's my understanding that an individual brought to the court's attention that the way the bill was drafted, it talked about lanes and did not designate what type of lanes were to be included in making that count as one lane plus one. And because of that, the court came to the conclusion that since it was not designated as any specific lane, should or shouldn't be counted, that it needed to count all the lanes. Therefore, you had individuals who were not, let's say, complying with what I think the intent of the legislation was and causing for some very risky situations. The highway that I know that was involved is Highway 101 that does go through north to south on in Florence. So what Senate Bill 591 attempts to do is to clarify which parts of the road are in play for which lanes are counted or which lanes aren't.
So basically what this would do is if there's a bicycle lane which is about somewhere under a half of a lane, then you'd actually have to have a lane and a half if one of them is a bicycle lane, a full lane of traffic and the bicycle lane.
My understanding is I think the bicycle lane itself would not be considered for counting purposes. That way you don't count. What happened is when someone steps off into the bike lane, that's the first lane, and then the next lane is supposed to stop. But what would you see on these highways that have four or five lanes plus bike lanes where people were basically in the middle of the crossing and the vehicles that I think were intended to be stopping in the sense of the cars claim that they were able to proceed quicker than what I think the intent of the original legislation was, because they were counting the bike lane as one of the lanes to be counted as to lane plus one. And so my understanding is that basically you'll be taking away the bike lane and then the part of the roadway that's used for basically parking and not including those as lanes for counting purposes as to lanes of travel.
Okay. Could we get Mr. Lear to volunteer to come up here? Your testimony dealt with this bill, Senate Bill 591. Are you prepared to comment on this? We'd love to hear from you. Thank you. Could you identify yourself again for the record?
Mark Lear, Traffic Investigations Manager, City of Portland, Office of Transportation. I would agree with Senator Pisanski's description of the bill. From our perspective, it seems like a good clarification in the pedestrian sting that was done by the City of Florence this summer. That was the contention someone made that the bicycle lane would count as the first lane. Therefore, the stop and stay bill really wouldn't apply in the way that I think the legislature had intended it. I think to just clarify what we'd be saying then with this bill is that the bike lane would really be considered part of the travel lane that's closest to that side of the street, and same with the parking lane. I think that's a good clarification to make if judges are going to interpret it that way.
Okay, and then if I could ask you, where these lanes occur at signalized intersections, if we add your compromise, which I think is a really reasonable compromise, to do a lane and a half,
right,
how would this affect that?
I don't think it would make really any difference, because we would still say that the bike lane is and the parking lane are a part of that travel lane. So it would be in the additional lane as you're going out or coming toward it that we'd be talking about a half lane. I've talked to our engineers, our state engineer, about this, and we don't, I guess, see any value in breaking out the bike lane and the parking lane as travel lanes. But I think that would be that is something that we want to make sure. And we're, I think we're going to have a second working committee to look at the change and want to make sure that that we've got that straight. And I think this will be one of the issues that we make sure we get clarification on.
That's great. Maybe we could just throw this into the work group pot and hopefully come out with a kind of a comprehensive approach.
That sounds good.
Thank you very much. Do you have anything to add, Senator Prusinski?
I don't.
Any other questions of either witness from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 591. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 938. This looks like a Prusinski bill to me. This is a Prusinski bill.
Mine.
Oh, this is a CTA bill. Okay.
Mrs. Scott.
Yeah. Okay. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 938 would amend a portion of the vehicle code to permit bicycles to pass another vehicle on the right and to operate a bicycle at a reasonable speed when approaching a crosswalk and to use portions of the road other than the bike path in certain circumstances.
Okay. Scott Bricker. Doug. Carol and Ray Thomas. I don't think I'm very good at reading handwriting, so it causes me to murder names, but my apologies.
As I said, my handwriting is sloppy as well. So.
Well, I'm not one to talk, I will assure you. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for hearing us. This is an exciting day in the committee with pedestrian and bicycle bills. I get to come up here multiple times. But today, for this particular bill, I brought a couple of speakers with me, and I'd like to introduce them in just one moment. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance, again, is a bicycling organization in Oregon. And I wanted to mention, I think that the City of Portland's not up here to testify on this bill, but as part of their testimony submitted earlier, they also supported this bill. I brought with me two speakers. To the far left is Doug Parrow, who is a board member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and in the middle is Ray Thomas, who is a distinguished lawyer and also an author of a book called, what's it called, Know Your Rights?
Pedal Power.
Pedal Power, and it's a book that compiles all bicycle laws, and he teaches bicycle workshops around Oregon, so thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Doug Parrow. I'm a member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance Board of Directors. I also chair the Legislative Committee for the BTA for the board. As I'm sure you know, Madam Chair, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance is a statewide organization that is dedicated to facilitating healthy and economically viable communities by ensuring that bicycling and walking are safe, convenient, and accessible. Each year, in preparation for each legislative session, look around to identify what kind of legislative issues that we think we need to bring to your attention. This last time, Ray Thomas, who really is the brains of this bill and behind this bill, brought us these changes and recommended it, that as an organization we asked the legislature to consider them. We certainly appreciate the your assistance, Chair Burdick, and those of the committee in terms of introducing this bill. We think that the changes proposed here will help to clarify some of the issues pertaining to bicycling along public roads. We did find in terms of talking about exceptions to when we think a cyclist should have to use the bike lane times when a cyclist should leave the bike lane, we did find one additional exception at least that we would like to offer to the committee, but if it's okay with you, I'll reserve until after Ray walks you through the bill talking a little bit about that proposed amendment.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Ray Thomas, and thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, for having me today. This is really a housekeeping bill that we've proposed because what we've found is that our Oregon revised statutes and the rules of the road have done a nice job, an evolving job, of recognizing bicycles and pedestrians on the roadway and in the pedestrian crosswalks. However, there are some things that just because of the language in the traffic laws sometimes fail to take us into account, such that there's either such widespread ignorance among the public and riders that they don't really know what the law is, or where there are recognized and safe practices that people engage in which are not specifically authorized by the law. This creates confusion among our law enforcement folks because they're not really sure what the law is, because they want the law to be explicit in telling us what to do. So there are three sections in this, and I'd like to just perhaps walk you through them and kind of give you a very brief overview. This isn't really designed to change fundamental rights. It's actually designed to make specific in the law those things which people are, by and large, mostly doing anyway. The first one relates to bike lanes, and I think, to passing. And you'll see in paragraph C in section 1 that what it allows is for people to pass if they may safely do so on a bicycle under existing conditions. Now, let me just give you a very brief overview of what this is involved in. It is that throughout the world, when you have a line of traffic stop, now this is not a situation where there's a bike lane, but I mean this is rural or city. You know, most of our commuter arteries don't have bike lanes. And so what you get is a situation where there's a line of stopped cars and bicyclists come up from behind. And what happens throughout the world is that the bicyclists move to the right side of that line of stopped cars, up alongside and to the front, and wait until the traffic light changes. Everybody starts going, and then you kind of see this cooperative kind of dance that happens where the cars are going faster than the bikes. They pass the bikes, and I might note, and you probably know, bicycles may be passed by cars when they're sharing the same lane with cars. That's what allows them to be able to do that. But the law does not allow, or does not specifically allow, bicycles when the cars are stopped to pass the stopped cars on the right. Now, if there's a bike lane, that's a different situation. Well, when you're in a situation like this where the law is somewhat askance with what everybody's doing, I mean, what it caused me to do was to take a look at the national law. And for you and for us, the kind of the gold standard in the national traffic law is the UVC, the Uniform Vehicle Code. And I'm sure you've all heard about it and worked with it. It's a wonderful resource for us. And it's kind of an odd deal, but if you look at the Uniform Vehicle Code, you'll see that it does, in fact, allow bicyclists to pass on the right. But because of some unfortunate language choices that we in Oregon made in our statute, we're one of only a couple of states that prohibit passing on the right, or at least we don't authorize it. And for law enforcement folks, if you don't authorize it, a lot of times what they feel like is, well, then it's not permitted. In fact, and I did this yesterday afternoon, I counted the states that allow passing on the right. 44 states specifically allow passing on the right by bicycle where they're sharing the same lane with a car and they can do so safely. The problem in the Oregon law is that if you look at the law, you'll see that what it talks about in paragraph 2a b is that the paved portion of the roadway must be of sufficient width to allow two or more lanes. You notice the word lanes. Well, in the Uniform Vehicle Code and in the law of other states, do you know what they say? Two or more lines of traffic. Now, the difference between lanes of traffic and lines of traffic is pretty important, because you can have two lines of traffic in the same lane. If one of them is a bicycle that's a width of 36 inches, and one of them's a car that is a standard car width, they can safely occupy that single lane. But so what the UVC calls lines, we call lanes. Now, a way to get around that is to try to change the law back to lines, and I'll tell you, since I tried to edit or draft the original version of this. I didn't do that because I didn't want folks who are, for example, my neighbors in Cornelius, to be afraid that what we're authorizing are motorcycles passing on the right side of a line of stopped cars. Some people have been in Los Angeles to see a line of stopped cars on the freeway, and a motorcyclist will come alongside the stopped cars on the freeway, either on the shoulder or on the painted line, at 60 miles an hour. And for those of us who aren't accustomed to this behavior, it's pretty scary. So we didn't want to have a situation where anybody would think that that's what we were doing here or authorizing. So you'll see in our proposed change that the only types of vehicles that can pass on the right are bicycles, and when they can do it safely. And that takes all the circumstances into account. And what it allows is a bicyclist, when they're coming up on a line of stop cars that's stopped for one reason or another, if it's safe and they can do it, to move over to the right and share the same lane. And it's the same way when a car is on the left side and a bicycle is stopped or not going fast enough, they can share the same lane with us and pass us. So this is designed for situations where there's not a bike lane. The second section is one that is one of those housekeeping matters that really creates an update that takes into account the fact that we don't just have people walking and people on bikes now. We've got people on rollerblades, we've got people on skateboards, and so having a law that imposes a speed limit in a crosswalk of an ordinary walk, I've found, is something that A, nobody knows about, B, frankly, it's hard to ride a bike at an ordinary walk speed and keep the thing upright because you're going so slow that you almost can't ride it. But yet the law does allow bicyclists to ride in crosswalks, and I think it's fair for motorists to yield to them, which is what the law is. All this does is say that rather than putting the speed limit in there that no one knows about, what you're supposed to do is go at a speed that's reasonable under the existing conditions. And we hope that that will allow a situation where the law is more fluid and we're not in a situation where people are ignorant about something that's just kind of a trap or a pitfall. Similarly, in Section 3, what we've got here is a change in the bike lane law, because we did a nice job in Oregon in creating bike laws, and then we created exceptions to when cars can be on bike lanes, but we failed to recognize is that bike lanes are sometimes occupied by buses, sometimes there's construction in bike lanes, somebody might want to take a left turn from a bike lane on a busy street, and the way that the Oregon law is right now, once you get in a bike lane, you're sort of a kidnapped hostage. You can't ever get out. There's nothing in the law that allows you to ever get out of the bike lane. So what we've got is a situation where if you look under the rules of the road, you can't leave a bike lane for any reason, or else you're in violation of this law. So what we did was we just cataloged those things that are actually taken from another section of the ORS, because we wanted to have good statutory language. And if you look through them, you'll see, well, of course, you can almost think it's kind of a no-brainer, but it's just not specifically taking us into account such that we need to include them by law. And this will help our law enforcement folks in the courts. And you can see, you could probably just think of them yourself about the ones you'd use. If you're passing and you can do it safely, if you want to turn left, if you're trying to avoid some debris, a bunch of glass or dirt or gravel or something, or if you want to have a right turn. Sometimes, unfortunately, you're in a situation where there's a dedicated right turn lane to your right and you're in a bike lane. Well, certainly you don't want to turn right from the middle of the road. You want to move over to the right and merge in with the motorists. And what that prompts me to do now is to use that as a segue to Doug Perrow, the chair of our legislative committee, because he has some personal experience with another either amendment exception or maybe through legislative council's smart wordsmithing, maybe they'll come up with some where they can include this in one of our other exceptions. But Doug, why don't you talk about our amendment?
Madam Chair, as I indicated earlier, we did have another exception that we would propose. Your assistant is handing out the language right now, and that would be to add an exception, preparing to continue straight at an intersection where the bike lane is to the right of a lane in which motor vehicles must turn right. That's not good design from the standpoint of traffic engineering. I think, as probably most of you know, typically what we have is a situation that Ray characterized in which the bike lane is to accommodate straight across traffic, and then the common and the right way to negotiate a turn if you want to turn right is to move over into that right turn only lane. There are a couple situations here in Salem in which, for whatever reason, the city built the bike lane to the right of a right turn only lane. Now, from a cyclist standpoint, the safe way to negotiate that kind of an intersection is to move over into the automobile travel lane that can go straight through the intersection, rather than get yourself pinned to the curb in that right turn only lane, or to the right of that right turn only lane. As a cyclist, you move over into the lane that is continuing on straight through the intersection. So what this language here would do would to acknowledge that kind of a situation where the bike lane is to the right of a right turn only lane, then the cyclist can leave the bike lane and move over to the left so as to merge with the traffic that's going straight through the intersection.
I bike a lot. I'm not aware of situations where the bike lane is to the right of the right turn lane. Does that happen a lot?
Chair Brittig, maybe Portland is doing a much better job of doing that engineering. Here in Salem...
Where are you from?
I'm from Salem, Madam You're Chair.
From Salem.
Actually, I'm from Kaiser. I ride into Salem fairly frequently. Cherry Street out here at the Salem Parkway northbound is an example of that situation in which there's a right turn lane and the bike lane is over to the right of it. Another example of that is down here at the Front Street Bypass right downtown where it intersects with Commercial, where the bike lane is over on the curb, and actually there's a right turn only lane, and then there's an optional lane, straight ahead or right turn. So if you're a cyclist staying in the bike lane, you potentially have two lanes of automobiles trying to turn across your path if you're trying to go straight through the intersection.
Yeah. Okay, I agree with you. That's a terrible design. Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much. We have Representative Dinkfelder here to testify on this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had intended to be here earlier, but I got held up in Water Committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Dinkfelder. I'm State Representative for Northeast Portland, House District 45. And as many of you know, I'm a member of the informal cycling caucus here in the Oregon Legislature. Several of the members actually sit on this august body. But I have been an avid cycler for many years, and I'm here to support these bills and testify in support of Senate Bill 938. And as somebody who spends a lot of time on her bicycle, maybe not as much time as some of the other members on this committee, but I logged in about 3,000 miles last year. I have experienced firsthand some of the situations that you've heard here today, and I want to commend the Bicycle Transportation Alliance for coming forward and putting forth some what I think are very good common sense solutions that would help make it safer for both the cyclists and the drivers, and make sure that we are going to reduce any confusion or possible fatalities. I've actually been in the situation of having to cross over out of the bike lane, which unfortunately puts you in a precarious situation because you have to look at doing something that's not completely legal versus doing something that's safe for the cyclist. So I think we really need to make sure and clarify these laws so it's safe for both the cyclist and the drivers. And I think that as somebody who is a very defensive cyclist, it's really confusing oftentimes to know which way you should turn or which side of the traffic you should be on. So I think that the points that Mr. Thomas raised were right on target, and that this legislation will help clarify it. And I also want to say that I commend the work of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I've worked with them for many years, and they do a lot of great work statewide on cyclist education and outreach. And oftentimes there's a lot of confusion about the existing laws. And I also want to commend Mr. Thomas, who actually holds clinics throughout the Portland and possibly other areas of the state to help educate cyclists about what the rules of the road are. And so I want to commend the BTA for their good work. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'm really here in support of this legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair, for providing me the time.
Thank you very much for coming. Are there questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As a member of the Bicycle Caucus, I hope we can get going soon. Thank you. We have Kat Iverson from Washington County signed up. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Kat Iverson. I live in Washington County, just north of Beaverton, in an unincorporated area. Okay, this bill amends three statutes, starting with the first one here. It would legalize passing on the right for bicyclists. Passing on the right is unsafe, even in a bike lane, actually. Cyclists passing a line of slow-moving cars can be right-hooked. That's the term for a collision when a motorist passes a cyclist and then immediately turns right. The cyclist may hit the front right bumper or may hit the car's broadside, and that's known as a right hook. Typically, your line of slow or stopped cars is at a traffic light, waiting for the light to turn green. If they're moving, but not all the cars in that line of traffic may be planning to go all the way to the intersection. They're moving along slowly, and as soon as the car reaches the 7-Eleven driveway he's headed for, he turns right. And if a cyclist is passing on the right at that moment, he gets hit. And although passing is legal in a bike lane, it's still just as dangerous and should be done only cautiously. And I don't think, if there's a bike lane, the motorist is obligated to check for cyclists coming up behind him. But if there's no bike lane, the motorist is in the curb lane and doesn't expect anybody to come up passing him on the right. He feels it's safe to make the right turn. The only conflict might be nearby pedestrians on the sidewalk.
Senator Pozanski?
If there's a line of stopped cars...
Senator Pozanski
has a question.
Just one question. My understanding, under our current rules, no matter who's turning which direction in a vehicle, they have to signal that turn for at least 100 feet prior
to
making that turn.
That's true.
So,
and I believe this amendment does specify that you can pass only if the motorists are not, if there's no one signaling the right turn? Or does it? It does not say.
My point was that I would assume that whoever's driving the vehicle, if they're making that right-hand turn into a driveway or at an intersection, they already have a duty to give everyone notice that's behind them, notice that they're going to be turning by using that signal. Would that make a difference in your scenario as to if they were properly signaling, then the bicyclist would know prior to going up on the side of the vehicle's about ready to turn, giving that legal distance of 100 feet?
Yes, that's true. If the motorist is properly signaling, cyclists should see that and not pass. Although even at that point, even if the driver is signaling, the cyclist may expect the driver to turn at the intersection. It may not occur to him that the driver is intending to turn into some driveway. And then, of course, motorists don't always signal. So it is not entirely safe to pass on the right. And I don't think it's a good idea to legalize it. If the line of cars is stopped, the cyclist could actually get doored. Passenger says, "Thanks for the ride, George, but as long as you're stopped in traffic, I'll get out here." He opens the door, and thud, the cyclist goes down. Also, if the cars are acting legally and have left, if the line of traffic is so far backed up they cross an intersection, nobody's supposed to block that intersection. Or a driver may see an oncoming motorist wanting to turn left and he may just be accommodating and leave a gap to some private driveway. So an oncoming motorist may have a chance to turn left across this line of stopped cars, and a cyclist passing on the right may not be visible to him, and the cyclist gets hit. So those are some of the dangers of passing on the right. About the only place it's safe to pass on the right is while riding on the freeway shoulder. And as for bicyclists passing cars, you know, stop traffic, just as cars can pass cyclists on the left in the same lane, cyclists are able to pass cars on the left in the same lane, and that is a safer way to do it, rather than on the right where motorists are not expecting them. As for the second section here, allowing cyclists to travel faster on sidewalks when approaching crosswalks. Sidewalks are not designed for fast vehicular travel. Sight distances are not always very good. Motorists may not see a cyclist approaching from down the sidewalk. A pedestrian traveling at 3 miles an hour, if he's within 3 seconds of the intersection, he's going to be at most 13 feet away, and a driver should be able to see him. But a cyclist who can easily travel 10 miles an hour can be 3 seconds away from the intersection, and he's 44 feet away. He could be even coming, and there's no directional restriction on cycling on sidewalks. So the motorist who maybe wants to turn right is concentrating his attention on the roadway to the left, doesn't need to look as carefully to the right because cars coming from that way are of no concern to him. But a cyclist could be coming on the sidewalk from the right and could be a long way down the sidewalk, could be obstructed by bushes, signs, and he could be there while the car is still making his turn. And yet this section, this amendment, still gives cyclists the same rights as pedestrians and makes motorists liable in collisions with cyclists who may be difficult to see coming from the sidewalk, and difficult if the cyclist is coming up from behind the motorist. Similarly to passing on the right on the road, the cyclist coming up the street, you know, the motorist has to check near the intersection for pedestrians, but if the cyclist is allowed to ride faster on the sidewalk and still legally have the right of way at the crosswalk, doesn't the motorist have to turn his head and look a long way back on the sidewalk?
We have your excellent written testimony, and I wonder if you could just maybe if there's any major points that you could summarize in like the next 1 minute, because we've got some bills that we've got to move out of here today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, let's see. One of the important points is that there's not much difference between a sidewalk and a bicycle side path. And side paths have long been recognized as dangerous and are discouraged from being built. The last one is the mandatory bike lane law, which I think would be better repealed for reasons I show. It's redundant to another law, which is in turn redundant to another law. There exists a slow-moving vehicle law saying all slow drivers should stay close to the curb. If you do amend it, as it stands now, it's in conflict with other laws determining where a bike should be on the roadway, for instance, making a left turn from the left lane. In case of any question, I would think, be up to a judge to decide which law would be applicable. But if you're going to amend it, a judge is likely to say that you considered this law and specified only a few instances of, you know, exceptions to being in the bike lane. And if you felt there were other exceptions, you would have listed them. So it seems better either repealed or left alone unless you can actually list every possible exception to being in the bike lane. And Mr. Perro has already come up with one today that he thought of after this amendment was written. I've supplied several, and I'm not sure I've thought of all the possible exceptions either.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I think we're going to cut this off now, and we're not going to move the bill today, but we will ask if any committee members have questions. And again, thank you for providing the written testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 938, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 230. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 230 was before the committee for a public hearing on February 24th, and then we had it on a work session for March 9th. It is the bill that would establish the procedures for appointing a guardian ad litem for an incapacitated, either mentally or physically, parent in a juvenile dependency matter or juvenile termination of parental rights matter. It is brought to us by the Oregon Law Commission. The proposed Dash 1 amendment, which was before you on at the hearing on the 9th, would list the specific duties of the guardian ad litem and make clear that the parent's attorney is to follow the directions of the guardian ad litem.
Thank you. Maybe we could ask Wendy Johnson to come up in case there are questions. We've already had a hearing on this. Maybe, Wendy, you could just share very briefly the need for this bill and why it's necessary to provide this kind of assistance to parents in a dependency situation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Law Commission, and I serve as the Deputy Director. As David Hendricks mentioned earlier, Legislative Council, the Law Commission's job is to do law reform and improvement. So we do some general cleanup things, but we also are trying to make the law easier to understand and actually work. This bill, Senate Bill 230, is regarding guardian ad litems. Guardian ad litems are required to be appointed to a parent when there's going to be a termination of parental rights or other matters in dependency. The statutes were unclear on what the guardian ad litem is to do when a parent is not able to assist the attorney in the defense, and it wasn't clear what the guardian was to do, what decisions the guardian could make, and also what the relationship was between the attorney for the parent and the guardian ad litem. So this bill clarifies what those roles are. There are Dash 1 amendments that were completed. They detail even more specifically what the guardian item can make, what decisions the guardian item can make.
Okay. Is it fair to say that the purpose of the guardian ad litem is to make sure that the parents' rights are preserved in the proceeding?
Chair, Burdick, members of the committee, yes. The Court of Appeals has had noted several decisions, and one that specifically said that the guardian ad litem needed to be included in a termination of parental rights case, needed to waive that right to proceeding, and there wasn't a guardian ad litem appointed in time or at the time of that proceeding, and so it's a right of the parent to have someone there to represent them in the form of a guardian ad litem.
Okay, thank you. We have a Dash 1 amendment here. If you'd just stand by, Wendy, in case there's other questions. We have a Dash 1 amendment here, and I might ask Senator Prezansky if he could assist in getting that amended into the bill.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 230.
Senator Prezansky has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 230. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Prezansky.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 230 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Prezansky has moved Senate Bill 230 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to oppose the motion to move the bill. I think the bill probably has merit in its attempt, what it's trying to do, but I don't think it clarifies it well enough, specifically sub 4, section 2, where the court does not have to consider rules of evidence under when they're regarding the hearing on the guardian ad litem, in conversation with Michael Livingston from the assistant AG, senior assistant AG earlier this morning that I had. We had a good conversation and thought we had a potential clarification for the bill, which would make it a good bill and more easily understandable for people when they're in these kind of situations. But because we don't have an opportunity to get that motion into the bill or amendment into the bill, I'm going to be opposed to it.
Okay, thank you, Senator Beyer. Is there other discussion? Okay, Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 238 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please, Mr. Penn?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Senate Bill 230.
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
No.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Four ayes, three nays.
Senate Bill 230, as amended, is passed to the floor.
Sure.
Senator Przanski will carry this bill. If that's all right with you, Senator Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Senator Walker wants it, she can have it.
No. Actually, Senator Brown chaired the Juvenile Rights Work Group, so we might want to give it to her, but...
Maybe Brown first, Przanski second.
Okay, we will make that offer. There's a lot of competition for Senate Bill 230. Okay. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 230. And... open the work session on Senate Bill 921. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure codifies the provisions regarding the appointment of counsel and notice by way of summons to parents in private adoption proceedings. It essentially codifies similar provisions that are in place for termination of parental rights matters in dependency court. There is a proposed Dash 1 amendment that includes some stylistic corrections. It also clarifies that the court may appoint counsel for a parent in a private adoption if it is requested by the parent and if the court determines that the parent is financially eligible. And finally, the Dash 1 amendment sets out the specific form and text of the summons that is to be used as notice and request for response to the parent, which is really the substance of this bill. It was before you on the 9th for a public hearing, and it's brought to you by the Oregon Law Commission.
Thank you. We had a hearing on this bill. Wendy, did you have anything you wanted to add to the council summary of that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, again, my name is Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. There was a public hearing on this bill on the 9th, and it was held over for a work session to allow time to review the amendments that were finished just that day. As counsel has explained, the amendments are clarifying amendments, making sure, changing the form a bit, and there was a mistake that we had referenced the dependency statute rather than the termination of parental rights statute for the standard for appointing counsel. And legislative council decided to totally rewrite section 7 to make it clear instead of referencing back to, I believe it was section 3 of the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Starr is gone. So much for Senator Starr. Senator Przanski, do you have a motion on this bill?
Madam Chair, I'd move the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 921.
Senator Przanski has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 921. Is there discussion? Senator Byers?
Is there a fiscal statement issued on the bill?
It says it may have a fiscal impact with the dash one.
Give me one moment, I can double check. I do have a no expenditure impact statement dated March 8th, 2005 from Legislative Fiscal. I apologize for not updating that in the staff measure summary.
Okay. No fiscal, Senator Beyer. Other discussion? Okay, any objection? Dash one amendments are in.
Madam Chair.
Krasanski.
Move Senate Bill 921 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Krasanski, move Senate Bill 921 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Okie dokie. Let's see if I can find my agenda. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 238. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. You have the dash one amendments in front of you. Permits injunctive, compensatory, and punitive remedies for violations of employment rights of firefighters, tobacco users, and members of the legislature. This bill was last before you on February 22nd for a hearing, and was on last Thursday, but we never got to it for a work session. Wendy Johnson is here from the Oregon Law Commission on the bill.
Wendy, if you could come back in case there's a question on it. This is kind of a hodgepodge of provisions that we needed to have for firefighters, legislators, and smokers. So, did you describe the dash one amendment to this council, or Wendy, do you want to talk about that?
Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Law Commission. I did prepare a one-page handout that should have been distributed before the work session today that lists out the various remedies that are available. The dash one amendments would limit the tobacco users to only the most limited remedies that are available under the statute. And then as amended, with the dash one amendments, you see at line three of the dash one amendments, it would also allow legislative assembly members and the volunteer firefighters to receive the additional remedy of compensatory damages or $250, whichever is greater, in addition to the remedies listed above in subsection one.
The main thing is that it eliminates punitive damages.
Oh,
for all categories, which I think is appropriate. Okay. Do we have a motion on the dash one amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Oh, I have a question.
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I may have missed a prior hearing on this bill, but what's the policy reason that you're pushing this?
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, the Law Commission took on this bill not to get into politics at all, but to provide a remedy for every right that's listed in statute. And we already had a work group that was in the area of civil rights. And so it was noted that the legislature already provided protections for these three groups of people, legislative assembly members, volunteer firefighters, and tobacco users. We looked at the various unlawful employment discrimination claims that are listed in the chapter, and it really was not much rhyme or reason why some claims got the better remedies and some did not. The work group therefore decided to put all three categories as drafted in the original bill into receiving all the remedies. It was with reservations that the work group decided to do that because tobacco users, frankly, just don't have as much sympathy as some of the other protected groups from discrimination. For example, comparing firefighters and tobacco users, and tobacco users, just for clarification, is only during your non-working time that an employer can't discriminate against your tobacco use during non-working time. That's what this provision is about. The work group did note that and passed that recommendation on to the commission that they were uncomfortable with it, but they decided that as policy they'd rather prefer
them to do the same. When the Law Commission looked at the bill as a policy matter, the Commission just determined that they were not comfortable adding punitive damages for any of these classes, and largely because of the expense of having a jury trial for all of these claims, and determined that their recommendation was to provide a middle ground for the groups that they felt deserved more protection, legislative assembly members and volunteer firefighters. And so the middle ground was to also provide compensatory damages, but for the tobacco users only, the recommendation was to provide only the least available remedies. Coincidentally, the tobacco users issue became national attention as the state of Michigan has it doesn't protect tobacco users during non-work time, and a company there had actually started firing their employees. So this was an issue that was on the minds of many people when many of the commissioners when we discussed this issue.
Madam Chair,
Senator Brzezinski.
I move -1 amendments in Senate Bill 238.
Senator Brzezinski has moved the -1 amendments in the Senate Bill 238. Is there a discussion?
No.
Okay. Are there Senator Byer has noted an objection? You're objecting to the -1 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Would you discuss your reason for opposing?
Well, I think tobacco users should have the same protection rights that other people do. I mean, it's a legal product.
So noted. There was some thought of taking them out altogether, Senator Byer.
I understand.
Okay. Clerk, will you call the roll on the -1 amendment, please?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr? Chair Burdick.
Aye. The -1 amendments are approved, and I actually thought, I could see that point on it, Senator Byer, really can. Senator Brzezinski, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 238 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brzezinski has moved Senate Bill 238 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? You're still going to object, I assume.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Clerk, why don't you call the roll again?
I don't think we need to.
Senator Burdick, if I could just interject, I did do some research and I could not find another state that did provide punitive damages to tobacco users.
Well, but I think Senator Byer's point was that we're providing a little bit better relief for legislators and firefighters. Did you find?
Yes. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, that there's a wide spectrum of unlawful employment discrimination claims, you know, across the United States. But when I looked at tobacco users, I couldn't find another state that did provide punitive damages.
How about compensatory damages?
Also, very few states. There were a handful, but very few. It was usually injunctive relief and wages and back pay only.
Okay, and so...
meaning you're hired or you're reinstated,
correct.
And you get your back pay.
But for firefighters and legislators, you did find compensatory damages?
Yes.
So at least we're not alone out there, Senator Byer. Okay, why don't you call the roll again? The motion is to send Senate Bill 238 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Okay. I will carry this. Okay, let's see if we have time for one more quick one. We will now... open a work session on... Do we have this list? Yes. We're really close again. Council Taylor, on Senate Bill 239, we were supposed to get a list for Senator Byer to look at of listing the protected rights. Did we produce that? Okay. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 239. Council.
Committee, Senate Bill 239 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission that modifies a list of protected classes of civil rights laws. This bill has no amendments to it, and it was last heard on February 22nd by this committee in public hearing.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pruszynski.
Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pruszynski has moved Senate Bill 239 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
I'm going to support the motion today. I may change my mind on the visit before. It seems like they're, after reviewing the list, it seems like we may be changing legislative intent in some of these, even though it was said it's not intended to change legislative intent. I haven't had a chance to look at it enough yet to, in detail to figure that out, so I won't object today, but I may change my vote when you support.
Well, I appreciate, and I hope you'll keep me in the loop as you review this, because I think the intention definitely was not to change legislative intent. So I appreciate that. Any more discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, this is the Law Commission bill. You've got first dibbies.
Okay. Well, that was my work group, so I'll take responsibility for it.
Senate Judiciary had a very productive day today and is now adjourned.
Madam Chair?
Yep.
I was just going to ask you, there was one bill, the smoking bill in public places, 494. Was there a hearing on that bill?
No.
Okay. Are we going to put it over, roll it over?